Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. On today's show, protests at the SeaTac Federal Detention Center, the Sasquatch Music Festival calls it quits, and more. First, our top story. President Trump says he'll name a new Supreme Court nominee next week to replace the retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. The new justice could determine the direction of the Supreme Court for a generation. One of the senators responsible for confirming a Supreme Court nominee is Washington Democrat Maria Cantwell. Senator, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you.
Senator, your colleague, Senator Patty Murray, says Americans should have, quote, the opportunity to weigh in with an election before moving forward to fill this seat. Will you try to delay a Supreme Court confirmation vote until after the midterm elections?
We definitely feel there is a whole host of questions we want answered to. So we definitely think it should be pushed past a time period, the election, so we can get those questions answered. I don't know if that's the date or a longer period, but we need to get answers to a variety of issues.
Will you be one of those trying to make that happen, trying to refuse or garner your Republican colleagues and try to get a movement going to delay a nominee?
Well, I think the key thing, as much as I definitely am going to try to get our colleagues to not put this on the fast track, but the larger issue is we need people to start talking about the important policy issues that need to be discussed. Is a new Supreme Court justice going to pardon a president? Are they going to uphold these important protections on health care like we're discussing here today, on the pre-existing conditions that right now the Trump administration is directing the Department of Justice not to advocate for? What about the emoluments clause, the file that basically has already been made by many attorney generals and others on the fact that the president is using his power in a conflicted way? Where are they going to be on all of these issues? And we need to start talking about those issues now, because if we talk about those issues now, then maybe we will get our colleagues to slow down and realize how important this is. This is not a normal Supreme Court nominee, if there is such a thing. This is a change in the balance of the court. We have gone from the current Kennedy justice, who has been a swing vote, to now going to something that is definitely going to change the balance of the court. Are my colleagues voting to change that balance and run over precedent that has already been established? We need to know the answers to these questions, and I think every member of Congress deserves at least 40 minutes for somebody who wants 40 years on the court.
On your list of issues, I didn't hear abortion rights. Is Roe versus Wade not on your list?
Oh, yes. That's, of course, privacy. Oh, no, no. Top of the list. Top of the list is the codifying, the fact that Roe v. Wade is the law of the land and has been established. And we could see a Supreme Court justice who wants to roll that back. I know that when I asked Justice Gorsuch about this issue, he said, oh, well, you know, your legislature voted on that. And I said, no, the people of my state voted on that. And this is so important to us. But the right to privacy and whether a justice believes that that exists within the Constitution writ large is a very important issue. Somebody might say they think it's settled law, but then say, oh, I really don't see it in the Constitution spelled out. That's what textualists do. And then basically vote to roll it back. That's a risk we cannot take.
Republicans have such a slim majority in the Senate, and Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine came out and said she would not vote for a nominee who showed hostility toward Roe versus Wade. But would you expect a nominee to tell the Senate how they would rule on Roe versus Wade? That's typically not said directly.
No. No. And that is why I'm talking about the penumbra of privacy rights that exist within the Constitution. And a strict constructionist usually won't tell you that they believe in the penumbra. That's why we have to get to a deeper level on this discussion. This is not a dry run. We know the president is saying he wants to change the law here. He's saying he will nominate people who will do so. Now, with this vote, he would have the ability to change a precedent that's been longstanding just because the nominee he seeks may not believe in that former precedent. So it's a much deeper conversation that has to happen. And my colleagues are going to have to ask about a whole host of things where they might say they're going to follow precedent, but then, as we've seen in recent court cases, all of a sudden they find a different angle on exactly how to proceed. So it's going to be very, very important that we get this discussion in the broad aspects of Congress, not be rushed through. And I would advise the president, since it's a 51-49 Senate, that he should be seeking counsel, the advice and consent role of Congress, and look at getting a moderate, not somebody who's going to have these extreme views like the majority of people on his list.
That's Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington. She says she wants her questions answered. She told me she wants at least 40 minutes of any nominee's time before filling retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy's seat. This is The Record on KUOW. Back in a moment. The people who celebrated Canada Day yesterday might not have squirted a lot of Heinz ketchup on their hot dogs. Heinz is just one American-made product on a long list of new Canadian tariffs. The new tariffs come in retaliation for President Trump penalizing foreign steel and aluminum. Here with The View from Canada is Catherine Cullen, Senior Reporter, Parliamentary Bureau at the CBC in Ottawa. Catherine, welcome.
Hello.
This list of products that will see tariffs includes U.S. steel and aluminum, but also pickles, bourbon, strawberry jam, and something dear to Seattle hearts, coffee beans. What is the strategy behind that list?
Other than making folks hungry, it is quite a disparate list.
It is lunchtime.
It is quite a disparate list, though, Bill, but there is, we are told, a method to the madness, you might say. The U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminum are going to add up to $16.6 billion worth of imported goods. Canadian officials say, and they chose $16.6 billion worth of goods from the United States that they are now slapping tariffs on. So just steel and aluminum from the U.S. wouldn't have been the equivalent to what the United States is doing to Canada. They've added all these other products. How have they chosen those products? As you say, everything from ketchup to sleeping bags. Canadian officials say that what they wanted to do was to choose products that could easily be replaced with a non-U.S. alternative. So best case scenario, that you could buy a product from Canada. For instance, French's ketchup, quite popular. In fact, the Prime Minister yesterday, as he was doing all his Canada Day addresses, showed up in Leamington, Ontario, which I learned was the tomato capital of Canada. Now, he never said the word tariffs. He never said the word NAFTA. He never mentioned Donald Trump. But there was a clear message there about Canadians looking out for one another. And the subtext was obviously a smart thing to do might be to buy Canadian-made ketchup. Another way that some of the products on this list were chosen, you look at something like bourbon. We understand that that is a message to Mitch McConnell, right? That that's a product that the tariffs are going to affect people in his community.
Tennessee bourbon.
There you go. Yeah. We're hoping that Canadian officials are hoping that by putting pressure on specific U.S. politicians, that they might bend Donald Trump's ear, the ear of the White House administration, to say, hey, this is hurting people where I come from. You really need to call this off.
Yes. Did I say Tennessee? I mean Kentucky. Bourbon.
Kentucky, yeah.
Yes. Did I hear that maple syrup is on the list? I didn't know that
Canadians
bought
much. We have a plentiful supply.
Yes.
Well, Vermont, right, for instance, I hear they have lovely maple syrup down there, but it's very easy to find a Canadian alternative. And if you're a Canadian, let's say, restaurant, and you're going to pay a little bit extra, 10% extra, to bring in American maple syrup, and why are you doing it in the first place? Frankly, I can't say. But it makes the choice a little bit easier.
And when we think, punish Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader from Kentucky, and him bourbon, we don't think coffee beans if we associate Seattle with coffee beans. We're not really one of those swing district players in that way.
It is, and there are things on there like strawberry jam, all kinds of things, and it's a very, very long list, a very disparate list, so I can't tell you how every single item got on there, but certainly it was done, Canadian officials say, with a lot of prudence, and in fact, there was a 30-day consultation period so that businesses and just folks here in Canada could weigh in and say, the consequences of this might not be so good. You might really end up hurting Canadians and not any American businesses. So the list was changed a little bit before it actually was enacted yesterday.
Catherine, as you say, tariffs just went into effect. What's the reaction been like in Canada generally?
Well, this really is, I think, stirring up a fair bit of passion, this idea that what is happening to Canadian business isn't necessarily fair. I was talking to my mom yesterday, and she was telling me that she was at the grocery store. She was eyeing this bag of cherries, trying to decide if the price was a good one or not.
Washington cherries?
Well, from the United States, I have to say. I don't know which state specifically.
We'll assume, just for the sake of conversation, that they were Washington cherries. Go on.
Well, and so she said the gentleman walked up behind her with his son, and the son said, "Hey, Dad, can we get some cherries?" And the gentleman said very loudly, and my mom felt that he really wanted her to hear this, "No, those are American. We don't buy American right now." And I can tell you that's not an isolated incident. Another one of my colleagues was out doing a story on Friday at an appliance vendor here in Canada. And he was telling him that one of the manufacturer's representatives actually came around and removed all the Made in America signs from some of these household appliances. And the store owner was saying, you know, that used to be a point of pride. It was something that Canadians might be interested in buying a product because it was made in America. Suddenly now it's a potential point of shame.
Yes, a cultural change. And Catherine, beyond that the tribalism, the cultural notes, what do you expect to be the bigger, or I guess more momentous, impact of these tariffs financially and politically?
It is, I think, quite significant. We don't really know the full brunt of it yet. Certainly politically, there does seem to be a lot of consensus among the various political parties in Canada that the counter tariffs are the right thing to do. As I mentioned earlier, Canada being very careful that this is a reciprocal measure, just at the same level. They don't want to push back even harder and elicit an even stronger counter response from Donald Trump. But this is going to cause economic pain. It is clear. We have heard from businesses who say that not only because of the U.S. tariffs, but because of everything that's happening, that they will have to close their doors because of this. We don't know the full scope of it yet. The Canadian government has put in place offers of up to $2 billion in aid to help Canadian workers and businesses that are affected by this. But the broader question, I think, is just how much worse this is going to get. Just the uncertainty of not knowing the future of NAFTA has prevented some investment in Canada. That's clear. It hasn't been great for the Canadian economy. This is going to make things worse. On top of that, there is always the prospect that Donald Trump is going to hit Canada with auto tariffs. That would be disastrous. One business leader called it Carmageddon the other day. But the economic impact would be much larger than just aluminum and steel. So there is real concern here. Canadian officials have said, listen, that wouldn't be fair. That wouldn't be rational. There's no reason for Donald Trump to do that. But frankly, that's what Canadian officials say about steel and aluminum. And here we are. So, you know, there is some optimism from our foreign affairs minister, who says she expects that NAFTA talks are really going to start picking up again soon. But how long all of this is going to take, nobody really knows. And the economic consequences do seem to be growing more and more dire.
From the CBC's Parliamentary Bureau in Ottawa, that senior reporter, Catherine Cullen. Catherine, thanks a lot for this.
You're welcome, Bill.
More of The Record on KUOW just ahead. It's The Record on KUOW, Seattle. I'm Bill Radke.
Families belong together. No human is illegal. And as Americans, we will not stop fighting until every single child is reunited with their family.
That sound from the Saturday rally at the SeaTac Federal Detention Center. Protesters spoke out about President Trump's zero-tolerance immigration policy. Over the weekend, more than 700 cities held Families Belong Together marches. Washington State's U.S. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal joined the rally in D.C. days after she was arrested at an immigration protest at the Senate building. The rally was just one of the big stories of the weekend, and joining me to discuss it and other stories is our panel, Leah Baltus, editor-in-chief of City Arts Magazine. Welcome back, Leah.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Susie Lee, artist, entrepreneur, former CEO, founder of the dating app Siren. Welcome back, Susie.
Thank you.
Susie, these events were under the banner Families Belong Together. You have said that this moral indignation doesn't necessarily carry over to other family issues. What do you mean?
What I was saying is that, you know, it's pretty clear to everybody that you shouldn't separate parents from their children. But this one instance is not something that it actually happens quite regularly. For example, when you have children that are in the foster system, right? Or as Leah and I were talking about with the youth detention facility. So to look at a broader context of why do you separate families in the U.S., I think is a more difficult conversation that we should have.
Are you saying it's somehow falling short to be not protesting all these other issues, but to be called to action when families and children are split?
Well,
is it hypocritical?
I don't know if it's hypocritical, but there's something about the magnitude of what's going on at the border and the way that it's tied into the whole electricity of the situation. Mm-hmm. And that's bringing out people's passion. And that's great. But hopefully now we can also apply that same passion to other kinds of causes like the one Susie's mentioning with the youth jail, et cetera.
Speaking of that passion, what have you thought of the call? This is most famously associated with the woman who just won an election in New York State nowhere, 28-year-old Democratic socialist. And one of her platform issues is abolish ICE.
Yes.
What do you think of that? I've heard a lot of debate about whether that's a wise rallying cry. What do you think, Susie?
Her name is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and I think it was a really amazing and sweeping victory that she did. It seems like one of those things where reform is absolutely necessary, that the organization, that ICE basically kind of got derailed in terms of what it's supposed to be doing or any kind of mission of what it's supposed to be doing. To actually completely abolish it seems like one of those things where you throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Why is that?
Because I think that there are ways in which you can look at any kind of organization that's not working and then go, it's not working, we should just tear it down. And there's a lot of things like that that I think is the sort of first impulse. But there are ways to think about, the safety of, citizens and non-citizens and immigration, and that we need to have an organization that actually does oversee that.
Some people are saying, you're just giving. Predictably, President Trump is saying, there's the crazy Democrats, they want open borders, and that this is tactically a bad idea to call for abolishing ICE.
Well, and I think that the people who are calling for the abolishment of ICE are, focused on the kinds of fear that ICE now inflicts on people who are in danger of deportation under the current situation. And that seems like a not great role for the government to be playing.
Mm-hmm. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, by the way, said yesterday on NPR that ICE was a creation shortly after 9/11. She says, in quote, "I will just say it has become a rogue agency with no accountability, no transparency, wasting taxpayer dollars, and a very misdirected focus." Let's talk about some other local news. I saw that the Sasquatch Music Festival has called it quits after 17 years of live music in the woods, so to speak. In a statement, the founder Adam Zak said, 17 years is a long time to do anything. The Beatles only lasted 8 years.
Quite a run.
Quite a run. Leah, you've been to Sasquatch, right?
I went a bunch of times in the early years. I'm pretty sure I went to the first one and maybe four or five of the first ones. Then I got old.
Well, is that what you think is behind the end of Sasquatch? Are its biggest fans aging out?
Oh, no. I think just, the whole festival phenomenon has peaks and valleys. And I think we reached peak festival maybe 3 years ago. And
but why? Why should there be a peak of festivals?
I mean, they're really expensive to put on. Uh-huh. There's a huge amount of risk. And if you somehow don't get that turnout, then the amount of financial loss can be pretty significant. I think it's Live Nation that's been producing it. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about the real reason, in addition to Adam Zak deciding to be finished himself as the curator and booker, that they weren't seeing the ticket sales. So who knows why that could be, but Memorial Day at the Gorge is a questionable weather moment.
right.
I've been in a hailstorm at Sasquatch, which was both memorable and not so pleasant.
And there feels to be definitely the corporatizing of all of these kind of festivals, where whether it's Burning Man or Coachella or, Sasquatch, that when, Leah and I went first to the original ones, that they were more affordable for sure. And they just seemed something that was very regional and kind of homegrown in a way.
How so? What about it seemed homegrown?
Well, first of all, the location, right, which is, you know, magnificent. And no other festival that I can think of has the gorge as its backdrop.
Yeah.
And
the Columbia River Gorge, for those newcomers who maybe don't even know Sasquatch yet. Yes, it's a stunning view.
Yes. And I don't know, there was just something about it that felt like, you know, these were, you know, even though they were great headliner acts, that a lot of the new and up-and-coming bands were local. They were ones that you hadn't heard of before and that you were just super excited to be able to see them in one place.
Do you remember who you saw at Sasquatch?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I saw an amazing Bjork performance that I'll never forget.
I remember that.
I saw that Beck performance where he had the band doing the crazy table banging, plate juggling madness. That was amazing.
It wasn't two turntables.
No, no.
That they were juggling, no.
And a microphone.
And a microphone, no. It's
I remember
something different.
The Bjork performance. Oh my God, that was amazing.
It was amazing. There were some great moments, and I'm sure that great moments have continued. I mean, I know people who've been going every single year, and they'll like get the sweet spot at Cave B Winery to stay like grown-ups, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's still really great. Some people are really down with the festival experience. They like to take their music with the thousands. I am not that person anymore.
That is how you can age with the festival, is you start out going all the way there, you know, and sleeping wherever.
Mm-hmm.
And then gradually your accommodations get fancier and you just kind of make the short trip from a convenient outskirt.
Right.
You know,
I don't think there was a KB Winery also in the first couple of years.
Yeah, that maybe didn't even exist yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember seeing the Flaming Lips at Sasquatch.
That's the
one we were talking about.
With the fuzzy animals?
With the fuzzy costume animals and the huge balloons.
Were you on mushrooms?
I was not. Why do you ask?
Just because apparently a lot of people were.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it was a good combination, the fuzzy animals and just peeking on a psychedelic experience.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. Are we talking about the same year? I think Jurassic 5 was there.
Yeah.
Coldplay was there.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that was the year.
Yeah, wasn't it all the same year?
I
and
can't remember
Nico
one
Case.
Lineup from the next. But
yeah, they blur. They blur. Modest Mouse. Anyway, yeah. So do you're with City Arts Magazine, Leah? Is there to you, is the loss of Sasquatch, is that good news, bad news, or no news as far as the arts picture in the Northwest?
I mean, ebbs and flows, right? There are other good festival bookings for local acts to get that will help them ascend in their careers. And in the meantime, the upside of all of this is that sometimes when really great artists are on tour, they will end up getting booked at something like Sasquatch, and that means they skip Seattle on their tour. And so now a lot of those artists might turn up in our city venues, and there might be more people who are able to see them.
Why wouldn't they go to both Seattle and the Gorge?
You know, it can be different reasons. I don't know exactly, as not a booker, I don't know exactly how all the blackout dates work, but sometimes there's that, and other times there's just, well, we're not going to add two Northwest dates on this tour. They'll do maybe a Sasquatch date plus a Portland date, but not, or a Vancouver date, but not a Seattle, so stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Susie, you were saying that there's something Northwest-y about our art scene, something about our kind of terroir, our geography, our style. What do you mean by that?
I mean, even if you're not like a big hiker, which I don't think I am, you know, especially as a creative person, you kind of absorb the idea that there's this this natural beauty here and this abundance of resources, as well as, of course, the weather, where it lends to kind of a hermit-like experience. Mm. But all of that, I think, created this this kind of, I mean, and this was before, I think, when we were talking about kind of the original days of Sasquatch, where I think as an artist, you could really hone and understand who you were and your identity and sort of learn your craft before you got exposed to larger cities. I don't know if that's there so much, and I don't know if a lot of the places that people were naturally able to congregate to kind of be able to fuel their creativity is here in the city and as much. But I remember that energy, like, you know, going to Sasquatch with groups of people that were also like artists that were sharing the same studio spaces, and then you would all rent a van and go together. Like, you never stopped being an artist, right? So you would go to these events and just feel like it all just kind of fueled each other.
I want to talk about another story that got a lot of attention this weekend. There is an article published in The Atlantic magazine last week called An App for Ejecting the Homeless, and it looks at the city of Seattle's Find It, Fix It app, which normally or originally was used to report potholes and sidewalk problems, some neighborhood issues. People have been increasingly using it to report homeless encampments, and it's done anonymously, by the way. Leah Baltus, have you used the app? What do you think of this?
I have used the app because, like, the street sign on my corner fell over, but I certainly didn't use it to, like, manifest my anonymous fear of the poor. I mean, this is ridiculous and disgusting, and the fact that people can use an app to try to shoo away any sort of visible signs of the duress that people are facing is horrifying. And if you're going to call someone and report something like that, you should have to give your name, and you should have to, like, question your moment there where you're talking to a person and making that call.
Well, what's wrong with reporting something anonymously? You don't want to. I don't want to get involved. I just want the police to know this is going on.
It's just an extension of NIMBYism. It's just the same kind of, like, well, I don't want to see it. I don't want to have my name attached to it. I just don't want this to exist in my sphere.
Mm-hmm. We were also just looking at one of the interfaces, and it's not really clear at all where you could actually report the homeless. Like, you have to be somewhat insistent and persistent to try to think that this app was intended for that use even.
Yes, I'm looking at the app categories. You can report abandoned vehicle, graffiti, litter/illegal dumping/needles, parking enforcement, pothole, sign and signal maintenance, streetlight report, other inquiry.
Yeah, like that other just feels like that's a big stretch. I do think, though, that by having people report anonymously, you do see the kind of darker side of what we like to kind of pat ourselves on being a very liberal and progressive city, that people like to say that on the outside, but when they sort of are faced with it right in their backyards, they tend to be a lot more conservative. And so I think this is a snapshot of that aspect of it where, it's like, sure, we want to support the homeless, but just not here.
Only in the abstract.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're linking the anonymity with someone not wanting to take ownership of their opinion. I thought someone was, I don't want to have to deal with a bunch of paperwork. I don't want somebody angry with me. I want to report this. And if the police don't want to do anything about the encampment, that's up to them. But you're saying there's a hypocrisy, there's a shell game in Seattle?
I think so.
I agree.
You could link to Facebook. It wouldn't, like reporting, it wouldn't be that complicated of a thing to do to basically attach your name to it. But I think it also lends to, you know, Leah's talking about people's fear of poor people, that somehow they're more violent or that they're, you know, that they're going to do horrible things to people. And you're like, they don't have a home. That's really their only crime. And so why is it that it's such a threat to see that within the block that you live in?
Finally, quickly, we've been asking people, are you going to watch any less football? We had the Seattle Seahawks safety Cam Chancellor saying, sounds like he's retiring, and he made a reference to pray for your boy. I have no clue how these head injuries will go after the game. Is this starting to weigh on any Seahawk love you may have, or Huskies, or whatever, or peewee football?
Yeah, for me, I mean, the combination of the growing awareness around these head injuries and the focus on it and instances like what's going on with Cam Chancellor and that, plus the national anthem stuff, is just kind of too much for me. I've been telling my husband, who's an Eagles fan and therefore is not really ready to give up
on his NFL watching.
But I'm like, I don't know if I'm going in on that this year, because I just it makes me feel gross watching it, which is not good.
Like a, you know, your racist old uncle that's like, you know, you're like, ah, this, yeah, you're not saying the right things anymore. You're kind of out of step with the times.
Mm-hmm. We're watching the fall of football.
Maybe.
Well, I think you could also ask a lot of parents of young boys and see if they would be tolerant of having their child actually go through that. And I think you'd probably find fewer and fewer of them that are okay with that.
Susie Lee, artist, entrepreneur, former CEO and founder of the dating app Siren. Leah Baltus is editor-in-chief of City Arts Magazine. And we get together and talk about what maybe you missed if you were camping or whatnot over the weekend. But thanks for recapping the news of the weekend.
Of course.
Thanks, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're going to come right back. Flying cars might be a long way off, but the world is changing faster than our brains can keep up. And my next guests are trying to keep up with that with a really an ancient technology, storytelling. A Seattle-based Scout.ai is a company that uses science fiction as a way to prepare businesses and governments for the future. Its CEO is Barrett Anderson. Barrett, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And we're joined by a couple of science fiction writers who have worked with you. Ramez Nam is author of the Nexus Trilogy. Hi, Ramez.
Hi there.
Brenda Cooper, besides being Chief Information Officer, City of Kirkland, you have written many short stories and 10 novels.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Barrett, what's an example of how science fiction can be useful for the government?
Well, so great question. So when we first started Scout, we used a Kickstarter campaign to kick things off. And as a part of that campaign, we actually put together a series of fake headlines from the future. And so
fake headlines.
Yeah. So we basically just spent a couple of hours thinking about, okay, what are some of the emerging technologies that we're seeing now? And how might they actually intersect with culture and society or in interesting or unexpected ways in the future? We predicted, this was in 2014, and we predicted that Hillary Clinton would have won the election because of the efforts of two Facebook engineers who were able to change the newsfeed algorithm to the effect that in key swing states, no one noticed it, but voters were incentivized to vote for Hillary. So clearly, if the U.S. government and the elections officials nationwide had been looking at that and thinking about that, if Facebook had been looking at that and thinking about that more clearly, they could have foreseen that, you know, based on the way that they think about development within the company, they actually, any two developers working together at the time could have made a change to the newsfeed algorithm.
Now, that could sound like good policy analysis. What's the fiction part of that?
Well, how that didn't actually happen.
That's true.
It turns out that the reverse of that happened. So it's easy to say now that that sounds like policy analysis, but at the time it was pretty provocative, right? So Donald Trump hadn't even entered the race yet.
Yeah.
Let's see, another one that we kind of put together was, this hasn't happened yet, but I think I will be interested to see what does happen, was that 23andMe had been bought by LinkedIn.
It's the genetic research
exactly,
company.
Exactly, so that everyone's genetic code was now available to employers so that they could screen them based on genetic predisposition to diseases, other markers. So,
and the genetic example is interesting. We had the film Gattaca. I don't know how old it is now, 20 years. I thought Gattaca, it was a good film, but I thought the science was terrible. But it gave us this idea that employers and society could discriminate against you on a genetic basis. And a few years after Gattaca, Congress passed a bill called GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, that says that employers and health insurance companies can't use your genome against you. Now, of course, that could be repealed, but I would connect the passage of that bill in Congress directly to public attitudes changing because of Gattaca. So the right story, positive or negative, can sway people in a way that no number of policy papers will ever.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think the other way that I see science fiction used frequently, especially by the business community, especially among the world's top technology CEOs, they're all huge science fiction fans, right? And so Elon Musk and, Vinod Khosla and Jeff Bezos, for
Paul
example,
Allen.
Paul Allen, they're all huge science fiction fans. And they are all using the science fiction that they've read as inspiration and also as kind of a blueprint for the things that they built, right? So the iPhone, for example, first existed in Star Trek and then was actually brought to life by Apple. Elon Musk tweets all the time about his science fiction inspirations. Like just last week, he tweeted, I should probably articulate the philosophy underlying my actions. It's pretty simple and mostly influenced by Douglas Adams and Isaac Asimov, right? So he's also cited Ian Banks and Frank Herbert recently. So, I mean, these guys are all using science fiction as this kind of collective map of a world that they could be building, and they are building it right now. So it's super interesting. If you're not actually reading science fiction, you don't really understand or have the same understanding that science fiction fans and science fiction readers and these tech CEOs do of like what they're trying to create.
As we've said, sometimes science fiction is scary. Is there technology being developed that scares you personally, Barrett?
A lot. So I think that the thing that most frightens me right now is the use of surveillance, particularly in China, specifically using social media and facial recognition technology. So over the last few years, the Chinese government has essentially kicked all Western media out of the country. And they have this new citizen control system that is a social credit rating system. They actually use your online activity, so who you're friends with on online social networks, who you're talking to privately, what you're saying privately in your personal messages to them. And they use that not just to affect your ability to buy a house, for example, but also your ability to travel internally or externally, internationally. China is expanding economically quite aggressively at the moment, and they've started to use that kind of censorship in the United States as well through their economic ties. So, for example, they recently, Marriott Hotels, of which the Chinese government is a part owner, recently fired an employee for liking a tweet that referred to Tibet as a country. So that's the kind of thing that I see in the most near future, or actually right now, starting to kind of take root through this increasingly pervasive surveillance that, you know, specific instances of the internet combined with national control create.
I would want to add the Internet of Things, which is, you know, all of the devices in our homes, the Alexas and the other devices. They provide a huge amount of value and a huge amount of utility for us. But I think they're also a risk because of security risks. In my job as a CIO, I see how many both
the city of Kirkland, chief information officer.
Right. So as I'm responsible for security for the city, I see how many state actors come in and try to, you know, attack us in many, many ways.
State actors are attacking the city of Kirkland?
Sure. I mean, not actors in the sense of actors in a play, but in the sense of other states. One of the things I heard in a meeting just today is that on one of our sites that just simply sells permits, there are more attempts to actually connect to the site from hackers than there are from people trying to buy permits. And so that's what our life is like. And so you have to imagine that these devices at home and our connected cars and our other things, of which there will be more and more because of the utility, are also always at risk because of security. And so
you have a worst case scenario. You're scaring me. And I'd like to know what specifically should I be losing sleep over? What could happen?
For example, someone could easily hack in. If you have an Alexa at home, someone could easily hack into that device and use it to listen to your conversations when you're at home. That would be like a pretty simple thing for like a good hacker to do.
Or if you have autonomous cars and you can hack into either the traffic systems or the cars, probably more likely the cars, you could certainly snarl up and damage, you know, traffic throughout the city fairly quickly and easily.
I'd add one more technology, talking about autonomy, drones. And I think, honestly, I think this technology is mostly positive. But when you said drone 10 years ago, you thought about the U.S. military with an $8 million Predator drone. And now you can buy an $800 drone that's super capable or an $80 drone. And it's not long. This is still radio remote controlled. They can be jammed, but it's not long until you'll have computer vision on them, autonomy. You can load up some GPS coordinates and a face and use facial recognition to go fly a small explosive right at somebody in a crowd. I think drones will do far more good than harm. They're being used for humanitarian purposes. There's a network of blood delivery in Rwanda that we don't have here, actually. But you will see scary stuff like this happen.
Can we talk about something hopeful now, please?
What
technologies are giving you hope?
I'll pipe in and I'll say the internet gives me hope. And this is a strange thing to say right now, because right now we're really terrified about the effect of Facebook and Twitter on elections, about the effect on spreading hatred. But I look at America, and something that science fiction failed to predict entirely was that we would have legalized marriage equality, that we'd have pot be legal in, 12 states now, about to be legal in Canada. And I see that as being really driven primarily by increased empathy. And that started with TV sitcoms that had gay characters on them that were sympathetic. And it spread to the ability to connect online, share videos on YouTube. Yes, hate is spread that way. But I think more impactful, but less noticeable, is that empathy is increasing that way as well. And I think that's a trend that hopefully will continue.
Yeah, I think that you bring up a really good case about the internet, and I think it's the same with almost any technology. For example, I mentioned some of the dangers in autonomous cars, but at the same time, they're going to let us get to work and be able to be productive on our way. They're going to enable us when we are old to get to the doctor without needing help. They're going to fix a lot of our traffic problems potentially. So almost all of these technologies really have both sides. And that's where science fictional storytelling can help both illuminate the scary sides of them and show the values and the advantages of them. Because once you show a technology actually being used in someone's life, either for good or for evil, as Mez mentioned earlier, you can really begin to activate people's imaginations and help them understand the potential implications of that technology. So then they know how to invest, how to vote, how to think, what to be worried about, or at least what to talk about over dinner.
One more I would add is synthetic biology. When I think about, you know, what are the biggest challenges that we're facing globally right now, climate change is probably number one, right? So we have a finite number of resources on the planet. But synthetic biology actually allows you to create essentially materials out of nothing, right? And so you can actually grow them in a lab in this way that we have never been able to do before, enabling us to, you know, cut... You know, there's a company called Impossible Burgers, I believe, that makes burgers that taste just like meat, right?
I had one the other day. They do taste like meat.
Yeah.
And they're really good.
And, you know, like, well, if you look at that, like, okay, cows produce a huge amount of contribution to climate change globally. These are the kinds of things that I think can have a really huge impact. It's still really early on in the industry, but it's going to be really exciting to see how that field develops.
And I'd pipe in that every technology has been used for good and bad, right? Trains got used in the Civil War and then in World War I to move troops to the front line. And part of the reasons World War I in particular was so bloody and killed so many millions of people was you could for the first time move millions of people to the front lines. Yet we would say, oh, trains are a net positive to our lives. So almost every technology has spectacular downsides and sort of less obvious or less spectacular, less dramatic upsides. And I think the news business and science fiction have similar biases, which is that fear or scary or shocking things get attention. So of course, most science fiction, I mean, any story has to have like a conflict, a challenge the protagonist has to get over. So there's always going to be some terrible thing going on. No one's going to flip through pages of a book of like, and then the world got richer.
And then people adjusted.
Yeah, poverty went down, democracy increased. Like, that's boring. We're going to read stuff about horrible things happening. And then the difference in some sci-fi is does it end with some hope or not? And the news business, I think, has the same question affecting it.
If our current time were a novel, how would you end it, Ramesh?
Well, I'd say truth is stranger than fiction. You couldn't write this administration. You couldn't write Trump as a character. Everyone would say that it's totally, totally implausible. But I'd probably give the dark but hopeful ending of some bad things happen, but there's a turning point. You know, maybe it ends with the Democrats taking the House in 2018. Let knock on wood or whatever it is this counter is made of. Or maybe not. Maybe they don't win and we have a bigger challenge in front of us. But you can paint the long arc of moral history, as it were.
I would say we're past the point where climate change is going to affect us. I think we know that based on our actions already, we're going to see some significant changes. And I would say we're going to survive those changes, but that they will drive us to have to figure out how to work together because it's naturally a global problem and we're going to have to address it globally.
Barrett, you said a book cannot end with, and people adjusted. So that's you don't have that option.
I think we have a lot of big challenges coming up ahead of us. And so, I mean, I guess if I were writing, I'm the only one here who's not really a science fiction writer. So I guess I may be the wrong person to ask this question. But if I were writing the science fiction novel, my ideal science fiction novel of the end of the world, it would be, you know, we have a lot of big challenges that we're facing. We have climate change. We have you know, these like very intense nationalistic competition really heating up. We have surveillance capitalism. We have these monopolies that are kind of like creating more and more and more and more inequality. And despite all of that, we also are creating all of these technologies that actually are the very things that will allow us to solve those problems. So in my ideal science fiction future, we would all organize using the internet to bring all of those things together and deploy them and overcome the kind of moneyed interests that have kept those problems from being dealt with.
Ramesh, will you please tell me more about something you said? Empathy is more impactful than hate.
Yeah, so if you look from 1970 on, There's a set of questions that have been posed to Americans, but an ongoing study of, would you invite a person like this over to dinner? Would you vote for a person like this if they were in your party and you agreed with them? Would you be okay if your kid married someone like this? And those like this, would you vote for a president, as I said? Those like this are Black, Hispanic, gay, Muslim, atheist, Jewish, Catholic. And on those questions, Americans say yes more and more and more often every year. Acceptance of difference, tolerance is going up in America. And a big part of it is that new cohorts, new generations are radically more tolerant. You look at millennials, they're radically more tolerant and more liberal on other topics too. But it's also the case that as people get older, we think that they get more conservative. They don't. People, as they get older, become more tolerant of others. Right, the older generation is still less tolerant than the younger. And so that is just a 40-year, almost 50-year trend in America. It seems to hold in other countries, too. So I think the combination of cities that are these melting pots where you see different sorts of people and media, whether it's TV and movies or Facebook and YouTube videos, are making us aware of people who are different than us and starting to see them as human and part of our tribe, whereas 40, 50 years ago, we saw them as other and a threat. And I think that trend will continue as far as the eye will see.
What can my industry, what can journalists, what can the news media learn from science fiction?
I think you can learn how much power you have, that stories are actually more important than facts in terms of persuasion, and treat that as a power that you must use responsibly. And so you must align those stories with what's actually happening. We have this notion of if it bleeds, it leads, right? That's what drives clicks. That's what drives ad views. And that gives people a sense that the world is scary. And people who are scared vote for authoritarians. They shift more conservative. They're more cruel to people that are not like them. And if people understood that violent crime in America has dropped by half since 1970, if that was the kind of news they got, they would be, I think, more tolerant, more welcoming, and more liberal overall.
Is science fiction generally more hopeful than what we hear on the news?
I would say it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, I think not always. You get a lot of dystopian science fiction as well as positive science fiction. I think what you can do is utilize some of the techniques of science fiction in the news. When you're talking about technology, think about how it might actually affect people and tell very short stories about that. It sounds a lot like some of the things you do at scout.ai.
Whether it's dystopian or optimistic, most, even most dystopian stories have a sense of heroism and of overcoming challenges. If you go to the Hunger Games, it's a very, very dystopian world, but it's a hero's journey of overcoming challenges. And I think when the news media puts out negative stories, they don't end it with solutions. They don't end it with, what can you do? How can we overcome this? And maybe that would give people a little bit more sense of activation and of hope and of less helplessness. And again, I think if people feel that way, they'll be more open-hearted, more kind to others, more tolerant, and think more about the future politically and less about preserving their present or past.
Yeah, I mean, in the last years at Scout, we've reported a lot on misinformation, right? And how the Trump campaign and Cambridge Analytica and Russia all used tech platforms to help change the outcome of the election. And yet in all of that work, the thing that I've found and really like been surprised by is how much of an impact we've been able to have, right? So we've interfaced with a lot of very high, you know, like politicians, candidates, political candidates, and just this really small team, right? We've actually been able to change a lot of the world and help the world understand this problem a lot more. Yet the thing that I find among the people that I know, right, all my friends and kind of acquaintances, is that they all feel more hopeless than ever. And so one of the things that I'm really interested in, and particularly one of the things that I've been just thinking a lot about personally, is how can you teach people that they are very powerful and that you can actually have a very large impact on the world through your work or through your activism? Because I think a lot of people just feel so discouraged. And that's one way that stories in the news media, especially, but also in science fiction or fiction generally, I think can be extremely powerful, is to showcase those stories of places where that is happening. It's very important.
We've been talking, speculating, learning about science fiction and hope with Barrett Anderson, Ramez Nam, and Brenda Cooper. And Barrett is with Scout.ai. Thanks to all three of you for leaning into this with me.
Thank you.
For having Thanks us. Very much.
And thank you for tuning in to The Record on KUOW Seattle. That's our show today, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Allison Bruzek, Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Tomorrow, National Book Award winner, MacArthur genius, poet Terrence Hayes. His new book is American Sonnets for My Past and Future Assassin. Join us.